KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm John Sepulveda. We begin in the Central Valley. That's where U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue visited the World Ag Expo in the city of Tulare. As governor of Georgia, Perdue signed one of the most draconian anti-immigration laws in the country. And that's why it caught our attention when Perdue acknowledged the importance of undocumented immigrants in California's ag sector. Valley Public Radio's Laura Satsui reports.
In a town hall meeting, Secretary Perdue told a room of farmers and industry leaders that he wants the Trump administration's rollback of regulations to extend to agriculture.
And we're trying to look at every regulation that may impede your productivity, and that's what we want to talk about today. I want to hear from you very candidly.
Perdue also said he hopes immigration reform includes provisions for undocumented immigrants who work in agriculture. He said they're a necessary part of the industry.
The president himself understands that. He understands what foreign-born workers have contributed to agriculture.
Valley congressional leaders of both parties attended the town hall, with one notable exception, Tulare Republican Devin Nunes. Today, Perdue will be at the San Luis Reservoir in Merced County with Congressman Jim Costa and local water experts to address another thing California farmers want, more water. For the California Report, I'm Laura Satsui in Tulare.
Orange County officials reached an agreement in a lawsuit with homeless residents they were evicting who were living in tents along the Santa Ana River. A federal judge ordered the two sides to negotiate an agreement. The solution will require the county to add 800 beds for the homeless through motel vouchers and spots on county property. Another judge, this one in New York, has joined a California judge's January ruling that temporarily blocks the Trump administration from ending the DACA program, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The January ruling opened a window for the more than 200,000 DACA recipients in California to renew their status, even as Congress debates immigration policy. KQED's Farida Javala Romero explains.
Science and math teacher Jackie Narvaez starts the school year by sharing a personal story with her middle school students.
Like, where do I come from? What does it mean to be undocumented?
Narvaez came to the U.S. with her family when she was a baby. Her story connects her with her students here in East Oakland. 70% are Latino. Narvaez says many of them fear relatives or friends could be deported.
Also, if something does happen to me and I have to leave, I don't want them to ever think that I abandoned them or just, like, straight up left.
Narvaez worried she'd lose her teaching job once her DACA permit expires this summer. But last month, a federal judge halted the Trump administration's plan to phase out DACA and ordered the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to process applications for renewals. Narvaez sent hers certified mail.
Oh, yeah, you got to send a certified stamp, make sure it's being tracked, make sure it's safe. And then it was just like, okay, let's hope for the best.
Immigration officials aren't saying yet how many applications they've received and approved. But nonprofit advocacy organizations in California say they've helped more than 1,000 people file for renewals.
I'd rather be safe than sorry. Like, do it before, like, anything changes.
Nursing student Carla Lopez is one of them. She's getting help from the Services, Immigrant Rights and Education Network, or SIREN, in San Jose. She says she's willing to pay the nearly $500 application fee, even though her DACA permit doesn't expire until November.
Scary, honestly scary, because like I thought this was going to be my last year here.
Attorney Shuan Riahi is with SIREN. He says for most DACA recipients, there's no added risk in applying now, since the federal government already has their personal information.
And they might get 2 extra years of work authorization and reprieve from deportation. I think the $500 is likely worth it.
The Trump administration had set a March 5th deadline for ending the program. But with the issue tied up in court, a ruling could take months, says Jeffrey Davidson. He's one of the attorneys suing the Trump administration on behalf of the University of California.
What it means is that as long as that order is in place, the administration cannot rescind DACA and cannot remove people who have current DACA status.
Back in Oakland, teacher Jackie Narvaez is holding on tight to the government receipt she got in the mail, acknowledging they have her application.
So happy. I remember I screenshotted it. I sent it to my boyfriend, to my mom. It was just like, look, I already got my receipt.
But she'll be happier still, she says, once she actually holds her renewed DACA permit. Then, she says, she'll be able to teach 2 more years. For the California Report, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
When Monterey native Olympic bobsledder Nick Cunningham hits the track next week, he won't only be representing the United States, he'll also be representing the U.S. Army. As KZU's Krista Almanzon reports, he's part of a tradition of soldiers whose job is to be an athlete.
If being an Olympic bobsledder from Monterey sounds out of the box, that makes sense. It's why Nick Cunningham tried out for the U.S. men's bobsled team. He had just graduated from Boise State, where he ran track, but he knew track would not take him to the Olympics, a lifelong dream.
I figured it'd be a graduation gift to myself to kind of do something outside the box, outside my comfort zone, just try something none of my friends could ever say that they'd tried out for. And so I went and I tried out, and 18 months later, went to my first Olympics.
That first Olympics was 2010, where he competed in the 2- and 4-man bobsled events. After that, Cunningham did another thing, completely out of the box.
Less than 2 months later, I'm putting my little thumbprint on the thing, and I'm joining the military.
Cunningham became a member of the New York National Guard. He's now a sergeant based in Lake Placid, New York. He did it to become part of the Army's world-class athlete program. It's an elite group of soldiers who have these orders.
They told me, go win medals for this country. And that's my job at this moment.
The Army's World-Class Athlete Program, or WCAP, is for soldier athletes who already have the proven ability to compete at this high level in an Olympic or Paralympic sport. They do basic training and advanced individual training like every other soldier. After that, winter athletes go to Lake Placid, and the summer athletes go to Fort Carson, Colorado. That's where I reached Colonel Sean Ryan by phone. He is Director of Communications for WCAP and a coach.
I think the biggest thing about the program is that it affords you the time. But with that time comes responsibility to maintain your proficiency in that sport and be eligible to make an Olympic or international team.
Soldier athletes began representing the Army at the Olympics in sports like boxing after World War II. Since 1948, they have won 118 medals in the Olympic and Paralympic Games in sports like wrestling, track and field, and shooting. This Winter Olympics, 7 Army athletes will compete with hopes of bringing home more medals. Bobsledder Nick Cunningham says having the chance to do that wouldn't be possible without the program.
Without the world-class athlete program, I would not be bobsledding still. I would have been out of the sport easily 4 years ago because of just the financial commitments that it takes.
This will be Cunningham's 3rd Olympics. He's going as a driver in the 2- and 4-man bobsled events. After that, he's not sure what's next. Another Olympics, a career in the military, or something else out of the box. For the California Report, I'm Krista Almanzon in Monterey.
Well, the past few weeks we've been examining the Me Too movement in a series called Beyond Me Too and considering the role of masculinity in society. KQED's Peter Arcuni, who was once a stay-at-home dad here in San Francisco, wondered what it means to be a father at this moment in time. His story begins on the playground.
A slide, sandbox, swings, discarded snacks and pigeons, children running laughing, a skin-knee lost toy, tears. This is my domain. A little girl and her scooter.
What's your name?
Izzy.
And how old are you?
2.
And are you having fun?
Yes. A wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time. Come on, Daddy.
I live for these moments here at the playground. But it wasn't always this easy. I remember that first day my wife went back to work, like being thrown out into the wilderness. The books were all birthing and breastfeeding. The class is called Mommy and Me. Christian Johnson, a middle school science teacher and father of Gemma, describes his experience.
I was definitely walking around like a deer in the headlights. I think I just walked probably half the city, strolling the baby, because that was what I knew would keep her calm.
Christian and I met in the sandbox, 2 dads in a sea of moms and nannies. I've been looking for another stay-at-home dad to connect with, so I made my move. Here's how he remembers it.
It was pretty much instant, like, oh, there's another dad. And then it was like, hey, yeah, I'm around tomorrow, let's hang out.
Bromance aside, I asked Christian what the 8 months he'd spent at home with his daughter meant to him.
On the level of, you know, the most important things that I've done in my life, it is the most important thing that I've done. I would never take that time back.
We kicked around what it means to be a father in today's society. Certainly more dads are playing an active role with their kids compared to our parents' generation. But it still wasn't the norm to see a dad rolling around the sandbox on a weekday.
Can I hold the sandbox? Can you come with me? It's a little shuffle.
But what is normal for a dad today? Peter Lippman always knew he wanted to be a father. He's my friend and the hardest working dad I know. A 54-year-old single father of twins, Daniel and Ava, age 2.
What's happening?
There's a few things you should know about Peter. 2 weeks before I spoke with him, he fell down a flight of stairs in front of his house carrying a stroller.
All of a sudden, I felt like I was rolling and I was feeling my head hit against metal and wood.
The fall broke his arm and he needed 25 stitches in his face. Luckily, the neighbor saw the whole thing and called 911. Then Peter got a stomach bug. His sister-in-law, Donna, who was flying in from Florida, arrived just in time.
She arrived at...
Puke 30.
She arrived at 11:30 in the evening on Saturday, and my stomach virus started at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning.
But Peter insists the challenges he faces are the same as any other parent, just trying to do their best. The harder part has been feeling judged.
It's like, I'm that person. I'm the single guy. I mean, the single gay guy, the single older gay guy. I mean, let's put more and more labels on it.
Peter eventually found his people, just everyday parents. They bonded over their kids or art, or in our case, rock and roll. But things still happen, like when a nanny walked across a playground to wipe his daughter's nose right in front of him, or when people speculate about how he got his kids. I tell Peter about the time I was shopping with my daughter, and someone asked me, "Is she yours?" The tone implied that dad was the last possible thing I could be.
Is she yours? What? Somebody said that once to me at the bookstore, and I couldn't even answer.
Peter decided when he was 20 he wanted to have kids. After years of rejections from adoption agencies and failed surrogacies, he was almost ready to give up.
And I realized, you know what? I really still am that 20-year-old who just felt that I'm supposed to be a parent. And I did it. And now I have my kids.
So I ask my friend, what does fatherhood mean to him?
All I can tell you is that when I say the words, I'm a dad, I feel like all of a sudden I'm like on cloud nine. Like there's nothing artificial, nothing fake, nothing sappy about it, anything like that. It's the most natural thing I've ever felt in my entire life.
So maybe being a father now is about casting aside some notion about what a father is supposed to be and just owning the experience. Or admitting that on the morning of my first day of grad school, my first day away from Izzy, I couldn't stop crying. That night I called my mom, and she said, "Now you really know what it feels like to be a parent."
That was KQED's Peter Arcuni.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, honoring the recipients of the 2018 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. Learn more at irvine.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need.
And that's the California Report for Wednesday, February 14th. I feel like today's a special day, but I just can't. Anyways, production of KQED Public Radio. I'm John Spolvido. Have a great day.